Welcome back to Restless Viking Radio, Season 1, Episode 7, the fourth episode of our Cape Jones story. I'm Chuck. I tell stories, I go places I probably shouldn't, and every now and then, I come back to explain myself. This episode takes us back to Chisasibi, where a single encounter, quiet, strange, and nothing like what I expected, would determine whether I ever set foot on the edge of Cape Jones. So settle in, take a breath, and follow me north. Some places introduce themselves loudly. Chisasibi does just the opposite. It watches first. And on this morning, I was the one being watched. All right, let's go. The commercial center in Chisasibi didn't look like a hub of commerce. It looked like a structure somebody had once believed in. The place was clean enough, but tired in a particular way that only a remote outpost could be. There was no vandalism, no neglect, just a kind of quiet resignation as if the building had finally made peace with being in the middle of nowhere. A northern store anchored one end, the sort of northern outpost market that sells everything from diapers to chainsaws. Smaller shops between there and the hotel entrance seemed to exist in a gray area beyond open and abandoned. Some had windows filled with cardboard boxes and mismatched furniture stacked like time capsules. There were faded squares of tape still stuck to the glass long after the flyers were gone. The upstairs level housed a small hotel. It was practical, but not welcoming. I remember thinking the whole building felt like a metaphor, an idea built for prosperity now surviving on the initial optimism. Inside, the air had that closed northern dryness, not exactly dusty, not exactly stale, but heavy. The fluorescent lights hummed faintly, fighting the pale daylight leaking through the wide entry windows. It wasn't a proper atrium, just an oversized corridor between two tired parts of the building. At one end, a lone Jehovah's Witness had set up a folding table neatly covered with literature. He looked completely out of place, as if he washed ashore here. He greeted each passerby with quiet hope, but the stream of passerbys was thin. I wondered what offense or overzealous volunteerism had placed him in Chisasibi, waiting for converts among people who already understood silence and endurance better than any verse could teach. Across the open space sat a dozen Cree men. They were arranged across the benches and picnic tables like ravens perched on a fence line. They weren't loitering, they were present. Their stillness had its own gravity. They didn't so much look at me as they continued to look at me. Their gaze had been on me from the moment I entered, calm and appraising. I was a new noise in their familiar silence. They were men of varied ages, a few older, their faces mapped by years, posture slightly folded from hard work. Their hair kept its color, but not its youth. It looked as tired as the rest of them. Others were middle-aged, still carrying the look of men who worked outdoors. Denim and flannel dominated, work pants, heavy boots, a mix of ball caps and wind-burned faces. No one spoke loudly. When someone did speak, it was brief, a line of Cree, low and steady. Sometimes answered, sometimes not. The way they sat, the way they observed, reminded me of search and rescue debriefings. Everyone quiet until something worth saying was said. I stood there for a minute longer than was comfortable, taking in the space. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to nod, wave, or simply vanish. Then one man rose. He was broad-shouldered, thick around the chest, and he had a gait that comes from years of outdoor work. His jacket was black and creased, his hands big and slow-moving. He walked toward me with an expression that was neither hostile nor friendly, just certain. "Where are you from?" he asked. His voice was low, gravelly, but weak. Not suspicious, but definitely not curious. It was a question that demanded economy in the answer. "Michigan," I said. He nodded once. "What are you doing in Chisasibi?" There were two versions of the truth. The long one involved my father, radar stations, maps, a pilgrimage that makes no sense to strangers. The shorter version was simpler, and I gave him that. "I'm trying to get to Cape Jones." He breathed through his teeth with a faint wheeze. Then he repeated it. "Cape Jones." As if testing the words. He paused again. "Who's taking you?" I shrugged. "I don't know. How about you?" He smiled with a flash of me being silly. "Have you talked to Jimmy?" The name meant nothing to me. "No," I said. "You know how to get a hold of him?" He lifted an arm, slowly, elbow bent, and pointed, without taking his gaze off me. For a moment he held it there, eyes fixed on me, as if he already knew exactly where every man in the room was sitting. He didn't need to look. Jimmy's position was as certain to him as his own. Then, after a pause, he turned his head slowly toward the man he'd been pointing to. "He's right there." I followed the line of his pointing arm. At the far side of the hall, among the silent sitters, was a man in a denim jacket, black hair brushed back, hands over his knees. He was built solid. His face was strong, with patience and distance. It was Jimmy. He didn't turn when I looked. He already knew I'd seen him. My new acquaintance started walking toward him. I hesitated. The space between me and those benches somehow felt sacred. Crossing it without invitation felt like walking onto someone else's ground. But curiosity has always been stronger than comfort, so I followed, trying to look respectful. Jimmy stood. For a moment, I thought he was leaving, and maybe he was. He turned and began walking toward the exit behind him, the perfect retreat if a conversation was about to start. Whether he saw us coming or simply chose that moment to go, I'll never know. To this day, I'm still not sure if he was avoiding us or if he was just leaving. "Jimmy," my guide called after him. Jimmy stopped, turned, waited. When we reached him, he looked at me once quickly from boots to my hat. Then he spoke in Cree to my companion. They exchanged a few words, short, efficient, carrying on without me. No one asked my name, no one offered theirs. Once more, Jimmy turned and looked at me. Actually, it seemed like he looked through me, then returned to the conversation. When the conversation ended, Jimmy simply turned and walked away. There were no gestures, no further acknowledgement, just the quiet conclusion of something I didn't understand. I assumed the answer was no. My companion turned to me. He said he might take you. "Really?" I asked. I didn't believe that for a second. What I saw was not a man interested in taking me anywhere. What I saw was a man who didn't want to be bothered. "Call him later," the man said. "He'll take you." His tone carried something between certainty and prophecy. He put a heavy hand on my shoulder, the kind of gesture that ends a conversation, then walked back to the benches. He turned to face the room, folded his arms, and returned to his post. The others hadn't moved. They continued their quiet, steady watch. I stood there a moment longer, half dazed by the silliness of it all. Out of some misplaced sense of formality, I gave the man a small salute, and he waved me off like a bothersome fly. "Fair enough," I thought, and left. Outside, the light was flat and gray. The air was cold and carried a mix of ocean and forest. I let the door close behind me and thought about the name Jimmy, how it sounded both improbable and inevitable. I didn't know it yet, but I'd just met the man who would decide whether I ever set foot on Cape Jones, and he had already decided I probably wouldn't. The next morning, I still wasn't sure if I'd been told yes or no. I tried whatever angles I could while we waited. I spent an hour at the Cree band office trying to find anything that might get us to Cape Jones. And that's when Amy texted me. "Jimmy came to our table in the restaurant, asked if we were the group going to Cape Jones." I left the band office immediately. Amy and I crossed the wet gravel and stepped into the commercial center. The bench where Jimmy had been yesterday was empty. The rest of the men sat as they always did, still, patient, unreadable. I scanned the room again, half expecting him to materialize out of the silence. Out here, people seemed to appear and disappear without explanation. The sitters watched everything, but offered nothing. They knew what was happening long before I did, and they weren't about to spoil the mystery by telling us. We stood there, unsure what to do next. "Let's come back in a little while," I said, and Amy nodded. We regrouped with the others at the restaurant, grabbed a quick bite, and then headed back for one last attempt. The moment we stepped through the doors, we saw him, sitting exactly where he'd been the day before, only this time with another man beside him. Jimmy glanced at us once, briefly, then returned to his quiet conversation. We approached him with a little more confidence than the day before. I asked while standing, "Are you interested in taking us to Cape Jones?" He looked at me with a curious and confused look. His friend sitting next to him said, "Cape Jones." "Yeah." I asked permission to sit next to Jimmy. He looked a little perplexed and nodded to the seat next to him. I sat and watched him. He looked unfazed, uninterested, and stared again at something in the distance. I wasn't sure where to start. He said nothing. I started with, "How much?" Jimmy smiled and laughed, and I had no idea why. I tried to think of a reason, and the only thing that came to mind was that my offer, which I hadn't made, was already too low. "Okay," I thought. So I said, "500? At this point, I thought to myself, what the hell? Is this some sort of custom? I glanced at Amy, who was sitting on the other side of Jimmy and his friend. She just looked back, seemingly as confused as I was. Then, with great relief, his friend, who turned out to be his cousin, said, "That's too low." "I'm Chuck," I said, introducing myself, the first time Jimmy had heard my name. No one cared. His friend spoke good English and said his name was Lame Boy, a family name, I assumed. He worked security for the town. And the way he carried himself made it clear he was there to look out for Jimmy's interests, not to make new friends. How much? I countered. More, Lame Boy said. Jimmy interrupted. Why do you want to go? The question stopped me. We'd been talking price and suddenly he wanted a reason. I hesitated. For some reason, I lifted my foot slightly, miming a step forward, a ridiculous little gesture. But it was somehow the truest explanation I had. I want to step where my father stepped. And they both looked at me. Something shifted in Jimmy's eyes. Not softening exactly, but a flicker of recognition. Lame Boy said, Really? Your dad worked at Cape Jones? This seemed to have struck a chord with him. I understood that the Cree take family seriously, but seeing their reaction made me realize just how deep this ran. We'll need gas, Jimmy said. And those next few minutes were spent trying to figure out if Jimmy was actually going to take us. We talked about where we were staying, where to launch from, when to leave. Jimmy closed one eye and looked upward, thinking. He worked out how many gallons of gas he'd need, what it would cost, how many people were going, and that we'd need 2 freighter canoes to carry 10 of us. But neither of them said yes. In a last attempt to get a commitment, I tried again. I just want to put my foot on the same land my father did. They both nodded with knowing understanding. We sat quietly for a while. I felt awkward and strangely empty. They were contemplating. Then Lame Boy broke the silence. Let's go get gas. We all stood and made a quick arrangement to meet at the only gas station in town. Amy and I drove there and waited. We talked about the possibility of a scam, but neither of us believed it. They hadn't promised anything, but nothing about them felt dishonest. They didn't show. Amy drove back to the commercial center while I waited. A few minutes later, she called on the radio. They were coming. They had gone to get gas cans. Jimmy and Lame Boy pulled up with 7 of them. They chatted with the attendant in Cree while I stood off to the side, feeling a little out of place. When the cans were filled, we all squeezed into the cramped counter area. The young attendant wrote out paper receipts and punched a calculator. Jimmy asked for 6 cans of mix oil. Then came the total to just over $200. He slid his First Nations ID across the counter and the attendant scribbled the number on the invoice. Now the total was just over $140. That's when it clicked. The fuel was tax-free if the purchase went through him. I stood behind Jimmy with cash in hand. I saw his hand slip back behind him, palm open, a discreet invitation. I placed a wad of bills in it and he passed it forward as if it had come from his pocket. He received change and, like a magician palming a coin, passed it back to me without turning around. With the fuel loaded, we all stepped outside and stared into the distance in different directions. After a while, Jimmy said, Long Point? Long Point, I confirmed. What time, he asked. What's good for you, I countered. He stared into the distance, thinking. For a moment, no one said anything. Finally, I offered, 8 to 9? Jimmy nodded once, then walked away. As I climbed into the Jeep, his cousin appeared at my passenger window, as if carried there by the wind. He rested both arms in the door, studying me. Then he pointed at me with quiet intensity. Be good to Jimmy, he said, low and serious. He's a good guy. I paused, meeting his eyes. I knew exactly what he meant. You know, I let the air breathe for a moment, that I will. He smiled and walked off. Amy and I drove back to tell the group. They had plenty of questions. How much? When do we leave? It's a Cree thing, I said. He'll be back tomorrow between 8 and 9, I think. With that, we left Chisasibi for the 50-mile drive to Long Point. We set up camp again on the rocks as the wind calmed, the rain stopped, the clouds scattered, and the tide sank back into the ocean. As we settled down for sleep, a deep orange light spilled through the windows. The sky turned blood orange as the sun dropped to the horizon. The wind died completely, and the sky unfurled in broad strokes of orange and deep yellow. And I whispered to myself, orange at night, sailor's delight. Next time, we wait at Long Point, watching the tide, the sky, and the clock, wondering whether Jimmy will actually show up, and whether this whole journey north will end on the shoreline, or go beyond it. Thanks for listening to Restless Viking Radio. If you're enjoying the journey, share the episode, leave a review, or tell a friend who loves a good road that goes almost, almost to the end of the world. See you next week.